More Idaho Matters now from the studios of Boise State Public Radio News. Across the nation, kids are suffering from a mental health crisis. They're experiencing increasing levels of anxiety and depression. And when it comes to looking at groups that are most at risk, well, reports found that students attending high-performing schools fell into this category. Now, this is an issue Jennifer Wallace looks at in her debut book, Never Enough, When Achievement Culture Becomes Toxic and What We Can Do About It. We're lucky enough to have Jennifer joining us today to talk more about this. Nice to have you on the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So Jennifer, before we really get into the book, tell us a little bit about yourself and the work that you have done.
Yeah, so I am a journalist. I began my career at 60 Minutes and then moved over to print. I write for the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal. I am also the parent of three teenagers. So I was noticing and trying to figure out why my childhood was so different than my own children's childhood today. And so that is what led to this 4 years of researching and writing and traveling the country, talking to families.
So tell us a little bit more about the book itself. I mean, as I mentioned, I mean, it is, as we're seeing, higher levels of anxiety and depression, and you having three teenagers yourself, God bless you for that, because that's a lot.
It's a lot.
You know what? It is a lot. I mean, where was kind of this jumping off point for you?
Yeah. So in 2019, three things were happening. One was my oldest was entering high school, and I wanted to figure out, I had 4 years left with him under my roof, and I wanted to find out where best to put my parental energy if I wanted to raise, you know, a healthy striver, somebody who could manage the ups and downs of life. At the same time, if you remember this, the Varsity Blues scandal hit, which was when parents on the East Coast and the West Coast were arrested and jailed for bribery and conspiracy to get their kids into highly selective colleges. And then the final straw was what you mentioned in the intro. In 2019, I wrote an article for the Washington Post about how students in competitive public and private high schools across the country are now officially an at-risk group. At risk, meaning they are 2 to 6 times more likely to suffer from clinical levels of anxiety, depression, and substance abuse disorder than the average American teen. And I wanted to find out how we got here and to what I could do in my own home to buffer against this excessive pressure.
Where do you think this achievement culture comes from?
So I spoke with historians, anthropologists, sociologists, and economists. I wanted to find out where the roots were. And what I found was, you know, when I was growing up in the 70s and early 80s, life was generally more affordable. Housing was more affordable. Healthcare was more affordable. Higher education was more affordable. Food was more affordable. And what we've seen in the last several years is an ushering in of extreme economic inequality, the crush of the middle class, hyper competition that's been brought in by globalization. And what parents are contending with today is the idea that their kids might not do as well as they did. When I was growing up, parents could sort of lean back a little bit and be generally assured that their children could at least replicate their childhoods, if not do better than they did. And that is no longer the case. We are seeing the first generation that is not doing as well as their parents financially. And parents are absorbing these fears, these economic fears about the future. And it's coming out in the way we parent. This is not to blame parents. This is simply to say, parents, we need to put into context the environment we are raising our kids in and understand that the pressure we are feeling in our homes is bigger than any one family, any one school, and any one community. These are macroeconomic pressures. And parents don't have to buy into these fears. There are things we can do in our homes to raise healthy strivers.
Mm-hmm. So let's dig into that a bit, because I sit here and I mean, I have a son going into the 10th grade, and I have another kiddo going into sixth grade, but you know, same thing, right? I think there's something about when your kid hits high school that all of a sudden you're thinking, okay, we need to start thinking about college. We need to start thinking about what they need to be doing in high school, right? And there's messages in particular when they go to certain schools about what they need to be achieving in order to successfully get into college. And I kind of found myself being like, okay, well, you know, you like basketball. You should be playing basketball. You should be trying to get on. You know. And all of a sudden he looked at me and he was like, why do you want me to do this so much? He was like, I don't want to play. Like, I want to play for fun, but I don't want to, I don't want to do this. And I mean, it was a more intense conversation than that. But with that said, bottom line was, is it made me have to take a step back and be like, yeah, why do I care about this? And it was like, well, I think I've been told that I'm supposed to care about this. And what I realized is I have a really resilient kid who does well academically. He's going to be fine.
Yes. I want to tell you, we
forget that.
Yeah. Okay, you are not alone in those fears. I conducted a first of its kind parenting survey with the help of a researcher at Harvard. And I surveyed 6,500 parents across the country, essentially hailing from every single state, including Alaska. And I tried to get to the roots of the fear and the pressure you were just talking about in that story about basketball. And I think one of my questions in the survey kind of hit to where that fear and those pressures seem to come from. So the first one question I asked parents is, on a scale from 1 to 4, how much they agreed or disagreed with this statement: I feel responsible for my children's achievement and success. 75% of parents agreed with that statement. And then I asked them, others think that my children's academic success is a reflection of my parenting. 83% of parents reported that other people believed their parenting had to do with their kids' success or lack of success. So we are, you know, feeling these pressures within our home to, you know, get our kids, you know, set up to be economically independent, whether that's going to college or whether that's going to a trade school. You know, every parent has felt the pressure to raise the next generation so that they are economically and emotionally independent. And that has never felt so fraught as it does today. So I think the pressures you are feeling in your home are reflecting the economic pressures you're feeling, the lack of diminishing opportunities that parents are feeling, you know, coming up, you know, in the decades to come. We don't know the kind of jobs we're preparing for our kids. We don't know with AI what that's going to do to jobs. But I'm here to tell you, you can take a breath, because what I did for this book is I went in search of the healthy strivers. I wanted to find out what they had in common, what their parents focused on at home, what was school like for them, what were their relationships like with their peers. And I found about 15 common threads that these healthy, joyful achievers had in common. And when I was—
Let's talk about that. Like, that's what I mean, I think every parent probably is like, okay, so what are those, right? What are some of those common denominators that you found in these healthy strivers, which I love that term rather than achievers, right? Or achieving.
Yes. They were excited to reach for high goals. So what I found, I found about, like I said, about 14, 15 things these achievers had in common. And when I was looking for a framework to present my findings, I came across a psychological construct called mattering. Mattering has been around since the 1980s. It was first introduced by Morris Rosenberg, who brought us self-esteem. What he found was that in the teens that he was studying, those who enjoyed a healthy level of self-esteem felt like they mattered to their parents. That means they felt valued for who they were at their core by their parents. And then in the decades since, we've seen people with high levels of mattering feel like they are valued by parents, by their peers, by their larger community, and they are depended on to add meaningful value back to their parents, to their schools, to their communities. So the kids I found, and what research has found, is that people with a high level of mattering have a kind of protective shield that buffers against excessive pressures. It doesn't mean these kids don't have setbacks. They don't have, you know, failures. They don't feel down from time to time. But what mattering does, this firm sense of mattering, it acts like a buoy and it lifts them up and it makes them more likely to reach for even higher goals because they believe setbacks and failures are not an indictment of their worth. These healthy strivers feel like their worth is unconditional. And those are the messages they got at home. Mm-hmm.
So I was just going to say that, Jennifer, I mean, that has to be messaging from home because look, there are many times I get it wrong, but one of the things, you know, that I say to my kids all the time is in particular, like about their behavior, right? Is I'm like, I may not like a certain behavior, but that is not who you are, right? Yes. Behavior is different than who the person is. And I'm your parent. So guess what? My job is that I have to make sure that I throw you out into the world as a functioning adult. So therefore, I do have to, you know, call you out on certain behaviors, right? And discipline and this and that.
Yes.
But that is not who you are. And,
yes, you
and
are.
I know that might be really simple, but I mean, is that something, an idea that you found with some of these strivers?
Yes. What you're talking about is separating the deed from the doer. So when we have to correct our kids, we can do so in a way that does not damage our relationship with them and two, their sense of self. So when I asked the researchers who study this population, you know, what could I do in my home tonight to buffer against the pressure? Mm-hmm. There was a phrase that has stuck with me and it was minimize criticism, prioritize affection. So the kids who seem to be doing the best, despite the pressures in their environment, are parents who, like you, when they had to correct, when they had to criticize, they separated the deed from the doer. And then they spent time prioritizing affection, words of love and affirmation. They, as one psychologist said, she recommends greeting your child once a day the way the family dog greets you, with just total love for who you are. There are lots of messages that we could be sending our kids, even unintentionally, about how much we value achievement. Sometimes they get the message that we value it more than we value them. So mm-hmm. one of the things that the researchers told me was to lead with lunch. And what I mean by that is when your kid walks through the door after a day of school, instead of saying, how'd you do on the Spanish quiz or what happened today on the soccer field? Are you going to be starting in the game? That sends the signal to the child that as a parent, you've been worried about this all day. And this is the first thing you need to blurt out when they walk in the door to squash your own anxieties. In fact, what we should be doing instead is greeting them either like the puppy or leading with lunch, saying to them, what'd you have for lunch today? Sending the signal, a strong signal that I wasn't sitting here worried about your achievements. I was sitting here thinking about you and hoping you were having a delicious lunch. There are lots of other tips that I offer in the book. One of them that I found really helpful was given to me by a psychologist at Harvard College who says for our kids, the self becomes stronger and sturdier, less by being praised, which can sometimes feel like pressure, and more by being known. So what I have done in my home is I've worked since researching this book in getting a PhD in my kids. What is it that makes them tick? What is it that makes them unique? What are their strengths that are separate from their achievements? Things about their character that define them in a way that's so much more important than a Spanish quiz or how you do in calculus. I will tell you the most surprising thing I found in my research. It might not surprise you, but it really surprised me, was that for any child in distress, the number one intervention is to make sure the primary caregivers, the adults in that child's life, that they are supported, that their well-being is intact, because a child's resilience rests fundamentally on their caregiver's resilience. And a caregiver's resilience rests on the depth and support of their relationships. So in our society, you know, we are sold by the multi-billion dollar self-care industry that, you know, take a bubble bath, light this candle, drink this tea, spend this money, and you'll get resilience. But actually, decades worth of resilience research finds that what brings us true resilience is having one, two, or three people in our lives who love us unconditionally, who are there to support us, see us, and validate us, to be those sources of support just as we are as the first responders to our children's struggles. So what I learned in researching this book is to prioritize my relationships more than prioritizing, you know, how organized my closet is. So I've devoted my closet organizing time to investing in my relationships once a week, at least for an hour, having these true connections.
Yeah, I think that makes such sense. It makes such sense that as parents or, you know, the primary caregiver, whoever that might look like in your family structure, that you have that, you know, that support. I mean, I just think about that with my girlfriends, right? And I'm like, oh, if I don't know what I would do. But I mean, and it's like, I know that there are a handful of people that it wouldn't matter what it was. It wouldn't matter the time of day. I could pick up I could pick up the phone and they would drop everything and be there.
That is exactly right. And it leads me to the number one mantra I took out of all of the research, something that I say to myself and something I say to my children, which is a phrase from Ned Halliwell, who's a psychiatrist. He said, never worry alone. And that to me is what resilience comes down to, is having someone else in your life that you can talk to so that you never worry alone. You never, you know, suffer in silence and in loneliness. You are worthy of support. Your children are worthy of support.
Mm-hmm. You know, before I let you go, what just hit me as you were saying that is, you know, I say this a lot, and you having been a journalist would maybe feel the same way, is what's the worst somebody can tell you? No. Okay. Right. I mean, because guess what? You're going to hear no in your life. You're going to hear it time and time again, especially in the profession that you and I have chosen. You not only hear it from people you want to interview, you hear it from jobs you try to get, you even hear it from jobs you have and they don't want you anymore. I mean, it's, you hear no, right? And so if you can have the mindset of what is the worst that they can say, no, we don't want you. Okay. Move on to the next thing. I try very much in my home to really make it that simple. It's like, okay, so no. Because I think there's such a fear of that.
Yes.
And we have to move through it.
What you're saying to your kids, this is not an indictment of your worth. This is just a no. It didn't work for them. It's not part of their agenda. That's it. That's exactly right.
Yeah. So what are you hoping that readers take away from this book? Because I have to say, I mean, as a parent navigating this right now, just to know that I'm not the only one feeling like this, is there is solace in that.
Yes. I want you to know, as a reader, you are not alone in feeling these pressures. It's time to stop blaming parents and put our pressures into context, and also to know that there are solutions. There are things we can do in our home to buffer against these excessive pressures. And it does not take a huge, you know, shift. It's small micro moments every day that deliver that sense of mattering and feeling valued at home that does such wonders.
Well, I want to thank you so much for this conversation. It is, I think, so critically important for anyone who is navigating life with children. So thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Want to learn how to be a master of business without going back to school? Listen to the Planet Money MBA. No suits, no PowerPoints, just the secrets of business school delivered straight to your ears. Every Wednesday till Labor Day on Planet Money from NPR.